Hello, and welcome to the Shifting Lens podcast, where we're viewing the animal experience. My name is Tiamat, and I'm joined by the other two lovely hosts, Rebecca and Molly. And today we have the topic of horses on the table, and the wonderful Shannon Riley is here to unpack it with us. Shannon is finishing her MA in anthropology at the University of Exeter and has really great knowledge of horses and our views of and interactions with them. So would you like to start us off, Shannon, by telling us a bit about you and your research?
Yeah, so I am currently finishing up my dissertation on Mustangs. A little bit about that is how horsemanship practitioners who interact directly with Mustangs, how they perceive of their wildness. And basically about my background as a horse girl, I have been obsessed since as long as I can remember with horses. I specifically got started interacting with Mustangs growing up at this natural horsemanship barn where the owner would bring in these Mustangs that were wild, and she either herself or with the other boarders there who were like trainers in natural horsemanship, they would gentle the horses, get them halter started, in some cases get them started under saddle and then adopt them into private homes. And so that's through the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM Wild Horse and Burro program. So that really just seeing a wild horse in the flesh, you know, I grew up reading books about them, hearing all these like passionate statements about them, movies about them. But when you see them in real life, it's a whole different deal. And in some ways you take off those romantic sunglasses and you start questioning like, okay, what is really going on here? So that led me to want to devote my research to them in the MA. And I currently have two Mustangs, I think ages 6 and 8. they are very feisty in their own regard, but I tend to see them the same as I see my domestic horse, who I've had since I was 11. She's a Morgan Arabian. My Mustangs are just, you know, just as tame as her, just as sweet and loving and as strong to be in a relationship with as her, but they grew up in the wild. And so, yeah, there's this whole other way, I guess, that I relate to them knowing their history, but in the present moment, they're just their horses. So I love kind of dissecting the relationships between humans and Mustangs, whether they were born wild, whether they just have that label slapped on them, you know, breeding wise.
As someone who's also a natural horsemanship practitioner, you know, when we say gentle versus taming an animal, could you talk a bit about why you choose the word gentling over taming?
Yeah, there's... in the horse world, I'm not happy with a lot of the language that gets thrown around, and
yeah,
I'm definitely situated more in the natural horsemanship world, even though I don't also like completely that word natural. They call it natural versus like normal or traditional horsemanship, and honestly, any kind of horsemanship that puts like the agency and the willingness of the horse first, I'm happy with. I don't care what it's called, but for instance, like traditionally they would say that starting a horse under saddle, we're going to break them in. And to me, I just picture like a new leather boot and you're breaking it into your foot. So how does that conjure the horse as someone who's equal in the partnership? So I tried to do away and dismantle that kind of language. But when it comes to Mustangs, it gets completely like exponentially more muddied, because we put the wild label on them to protect them. So there's a legal definition in place to protect them from harassment, from being sold to slaughter. And as much as I don't like the wild definition, and I'm probably going to be hated in like the wild horse advocacy world for that, I also know that, okay, we can't just throw out that label, because feral is what people who tend to view them as pests, as like invasive, you know, kind of parasites that will strip the land and compete with cattle or sheep for forage. Feral kind of undermines their protection legally. So Underneath that, you get the wild and the tame in like a behavior context. So I will refer to Mustangs who have had no interaction with humans as wild, but I don't mean that in a biological sense, which to the average person, it's like wild is wild. How are you saying that it's different that, you know, biologically they're not wild, but behaviorally they are? So that's just one of those words that casts such a huge net. It's kind of something that I'd rather not use, period, but with Mustangs you're forced to. And so I in my paper will refer to like a horse who has no interaction with humans, who's then going into the human world becoming tame. But as a trainer, I would refer to that process as like gentling the horse. So there's a million and one ways to like train a Mustang to get them habituated to the human world. But gentling just implies to me that it was done like really slowly at the horse's pace with like their willingness in mind, versus there are still some old school trainers who just, they have a deadline. They have like this many days. They use whatever kind of tools or mechanisms necessary to make the horse basically okay to be around humans and safe to handle. But it's really just, you know, it's losing their trust in that process. So yeah. Gentling is a huge, huge thing that I think is catching on more and more, especially with the natural horsemanship world. But like I said, I guess I get lost in that terminology. It's like there's no perfect way to describe what exactly a Mustang is. And then they go through all these phases of like being in different classifications with humans that it just kind of makes your head spin. So yeah, you come from the dog world, a lot of you guys do, so we can kind of relate it to like a rescue dog, how people who adopted a dog from a shelter could say like, oh, they have this behavior issue going on because they're a rescue. And Mustang people kind of do that to say like, well, my horse doesn't behave perfectly because they're wild. And well, why are we kind of putting our like human labels on that? They are who they are, and it's right. Up to us to not project that onto them.
I guess that circles back to the whole accepting them as individuals, including their animalness, and not just how much they're fitting into our lives or how similar they are to our ways and us as individuals, but embracing that quote unquote animal side as well of it.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
What do you think are people's motivations to tame Mustangs?
So I think that's something I really love diving into, because I think there's kind of two main motivations. It could be endless. One of the huge motivations right now is like the adoption orientation, because you have the federal government managing these horses and they're being rounded up because they're overpopulating on the range. So they have to bring them in. They have them sitting in like shorter long-term holding facilities until they get adopted. So it's generally like you're saving a horse's life from sitting in a government holding cell if you can adopt them. And it's kind of making the public redefine, you know, where a wild horse belongs. And so I think it's a double-edged sword. It's like, okay, the public is having to interact with these wild horses who grew up on the range, far from a human world. And it can, on the one hand, be beautiful to watch a relationship be formed where, you know, the human just wants the horse to have a good life. And then on the other hand, it can be kind of a practice in ego where someone says like, okay, I'm going to show my abilities as a trainer and let the public know. They think that this horse is like wild and untamable, and I'm going to train them and make them do all these things that are complete opposite and contrary to like their instincts and how they grew up. There are also several competitions that are in place. They're called like the Extreme Mustang Makeovers. And to me, I cringe at those words, even though growing up seeing those competitions in person, my eyes lit up and I was completely amazed at what these trainers could do with these wild horses. But now I just question, like, why do we have to make it something so extreme? It's not like you're taking a wolf and trying to make it into this like guide dog for the blind, right? These Mustangs are already domestic. They're technically feral. So you can literally, through the process of gentling, just taking the time it takes, you can have that relationship with them. It doesn't have to be this extreme thing. And like they give the trainers 30 days. And I think the point of these competitions or showcases is to show the public, like, look, what you thought was wild, it actually doesn't have to be this way. Like, these Mustangs are amazing partners to humans. They are adaptable. They could be trail horses, endurance horses. They're really well suited to that. But then on the other hand, now they're being used, partnered with rather, as like these amazing competition show horses. They can do dressage. They can do jumping. I met a trainer based in Florida who was going to all these different Mustang sanctuaries looking for like her jumping horse, and her goal is to compete at the Olympics. And she wanted the Mustang to have the brand so that she could show the public, like, yes, these horses can do it. They're capable. They're amazing partners. But then at the same time, it's like, it's not that the horses are not capable of that. It's our perception of them. So we're really kind of shooting them in the foot to say that, you know, it has to be this extreme change. And of course, I think that while the adoption orientation is pretty noble, I think that not all Mustangs that grew up in the wild are really suited for a domestic life, period. And that's where sanctuaries come in. And Tiamat, the branch that you and I grew up at, there was one Mustang there named Harmony, and she was in a traumatic situation when she first came into like the domestic world. I think her adopter had left a halter on her face and it had like grown over the skin and everything. They had to like cut the halter off, and she was just completely like, nope, I'm
not at the ranch, by the way, not at the ranch we were at, by the way,
right?
Before, right. Just to clarify,
no, she found herself at the ranch where we grew up at Windhorse after being saved from that situation, wherever that was. And you know, that's not just with Mustangs that they find themselves in abusive situations, but I think it's easier for them to be kind of abusively handled because they're already so frightened of humans. And people think, oh, if I just get a halter on them, then I can catch them, then I can make them do all these things. And then it's really, well, yeah, you can catch them, you can put them in a small pen, and you can force them to be close to you, but they never consented to that. And so Harmony, after she came to that ranch, she just, no matter how soft and sweet and compassionate the person's like invitation to interact with her was, she just wanted nothing to do with humans. And the owner of the ranch finally said, like, okay, I'm not going to force you to interact with me. And she sent her to a sanctuary where she's still living now on like hundreds of acres, just being wild. And that's the life that she needed. So the adoption orientation doesn't work for every horse. And then of course you kind of get in this dangerous belief that we should manage horses on the range to make them suitable for human homes, when basically that's like a large scale breeding operation conducted by the government. So the hands-off versus hands-on approach, you know, you're treading a really fine line, and there's no perfect way of managing them, but
right.
Yeah, I think it's easy to exposed to these images of horses, of wild horses, where we think that they don't belong with humans, they shouldn't be rounded up, period, they shouldn't be interfered with us in any way. And we're in the situation with the BLM, with everything right now, that the horses literally need that. And there aren't enough great alternatives out there to keep them on the range healthy and keeping everything thriving ecosystem wise. So when it's just the situation that you can kind of put your guilt aside and say, like, I didn't choose to round you up, I'm sorry that you're here, but now we're interacting. And at times with me during the gentling process, especially when I worked at a Mustang sanctuary in Northern California, there were over 200 wild horses there. And when they were brought to the sanctuary, some of the mares were pregnant. So then the babies, they quickly realized, like, okay, we have too many horses and we can't sustainably keep them all here. So we have to gentle the babies and get them adopted into homes, even though that's not what the sanctuary wanted to be about. They are not about adopting wild horses into private homes, but inevitably they had to do that. And as a trainer there, I was so happy just to spend like the entire day gentling Mustangs, but then seeing like some of the horses there got to live there for the rest of their lives as wild horses, I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm like, I'm a part of this horse now leaving this life that I think is ideal. Like if this were a human I was having a conversation with, wouldn't they hate me? Like, wouldn't I have to kind of defend, like, I'm so sorry that I'm doing this to you. And it became like a conflict in me as a trainer in a whole new way. And so I wanted to learn more about alternatives to rounding up. I got really heavy into like the whole advocacy thing with wild horses, but now in the program, I appreciate that. I realize, you know, in so many ways, it's still, horses can be happy in domestic settings, right? But we also expect them to kind of act as tools for us to be used. And Tiamat, the way that you and I were exposed to horsemanship was so contrary to that. Like, we were so lucky to experience that. There were some days we would let our horse out of the paddock to run on however many acres this ranch was. And if they didn't want us to catch them, there was no way we could catch them. If they didn't want us to ride them, there was no way we could ride them. We didn't just cross tie them in a barn, saddle them, interact with them for 1 hour by like riding them and then put them away and then not think about them. It was like every aspect of our relationship was something that we wanted the horse to be equally wanting and like desiring to interact with us. And
well, yeah, I mean, think of the amount of days where we just in high school would take our book or our homework into the pasture and just be like spending time with them, but not asking anything of them. They're just grazing and we're just sitting there, whether they're here or on the other side of the pasture, they're just.
I'm loving this. And it's funny because I'm writing down questions as we're going. And I mean, really, Shannon's like hitting them before I even get a chance to ask. So I think it's great. I mean, I was starting to think about that space for wild horses. And so I guess I'll continue that note. You know, we're coming from where I was from on the East Coast and then moving to the Rocky Mountains. You know, you have this romanticized version of the story, living nowhere near it. And now coming out here, partway to Bozeman, there's a beautiful art sculpture piece on this hill of all of these cutouts of made in, I think they're metal, of what looked like a herd of wild horses at one time. And it's really, whenever I drive by it, I have this weird feeling in my stomach where I'm like, well, why aren't those horses standing on a hill right there? Why is that an art installation? And I feel like maybe you're the person to ask about where is the space for wild horses now? And what do you think the future of that is going to look like?
Honestly, it's hard for me to not be cynical about that.
Okay.
I love that you get to drive by that representation, because Montana, I think, like, horse country, wild horse country. And where I am in Northern California, there is absolutely no room here for you know, a wild horse sanctuary for a wild herd area. The really amazing thing is learning the history of Mustangs after they were brought to the United States by the Spanish. They basically took over the continent. They ran all over, and there's reports that say that there were as many as like 1 to 2 million. Wow. During the early, I think it was, oh my gosh, 1850s to 1900s. Especially in California where I am, they were like all up and down the coast, and they were just like taking over the hills. But what happened to really get us down to now, I think we're, oh my gosh, and the numbers are not perfect here because counting wild horses, I can't imagine, is a perfect art in any way, but we have over, I think, 40, 50,000 in holding facilities that are still technically wild. And then we have more than that, I would say 60 to 80,000 probably on the range. They want significantly less than that. The tricky thing is about the way that they're managed now, though, is wild horse areas, herd management areas, HMAs, they're basically distributed at these places where Mustangs were found when the 1971 law was enacted, which is the Wild Horse, the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act. So that's not where these horses decided, like, oh yeah, this is my territory. This is just where they were chased into these canyons, and like basically these were the last stands where they were safe because they were so hunted by Mustangers, by government who wanted them gone because they were competing with cattle, with sheep. The horses themselves were forced to retreat. They would probably still be all over the country if they had their say. They don't just prefer these areas, but now especially more than 50% are located in Nevada, which I really, really want to go travel there, but I know is like some of the driest, harshest country, and it's wild horse country. You'd think like horses can't survive there. How on earth are there so many thousands of horses there? But it's because they retreated from humans trying to find the last safe place, and now they're kept there because the legal definition of a wild horse is those that are located in these areas. And the really interesting thing where I still get confused is a wild horse is these Mustangs in these areas, and they're protected by the federal government. But say they stray across that HMA, that herd management area line, they are then either belonging to the state, belonging to an indigenous reservation, or they're not considered protected at all. They would just be like another feral roaming animal. So geographically, so much is contingent upon just their location. And it's really sad that we can't just say that there's a perfect way to manage them, because it depends so much on where they're located. Some people have proposed, like, let's increase the amount of natural predators to cap their overpopulation, right? Like mountain lions. But what's happening is the mountain lions are still being hunted because they also are a threat to livestock industry. So the horses that actually would interact with natural predators, they're able to not venture into those like remote places with trees where they instinctively don't want to go. They know that the predators are there lurking. So It's kind of humans in so many ways. They're saying like, okay, let's make these horses wild. They belong here, but then we're also not permitting the cycle to just take place. We're eliminating the predators. We're putting our different needs first, because we want ranching, we want mineral extraction, all of these things. So it's never going to be a perfect scenario of like horses running on a hill, unless I think it's at a sanctuary if it's private property and it can be managed a certain way. And in those cases, the horses are on some type of birth control, or the mares are separated from the stallions to keep populations from increasing. And that's still absolutely not wild in so many ways.
It's so interesting what you're talking about too, because it reminds me of conversations in Montana about bison. Sorry, there's the bird. But it's so interesting talking about, again, that the priority goes to the cattle. And that's the same reason the bison don't, if they roam out of Yellowstone, they get shot. I mean, out here we have some bison ranges and some are carefully raised on the reservations, but anything wandering with a fear of brucellosis getting into the cattle population, that's the primary fear. They will shoot bison that get out of that space. They are on, I mean, and just hearing what you're saying about the overlap, it sounds like with how we treat indigenous populations, that you need to be on your property that we set aside for you. And, you know, it's pretty, it's interesting, it's disturbing. The overlap with study of geographies is fascinating, but, you know, I was, as we were talking, I was like, yeah, you know, what is the status in Montana? Cause I'm deeply ignorant, but knowing that there's only one herd in Montana that is still a free roaming population of wild horses, it's just like, yeah, you think we have all this space, why can't we share more of it? But concern for cattle, you know, all of that, it's just such an interesting conflict that's present there. So I really appreciate that information.
Yeah, I imagine it can be really maddening to see, like, you're seeing this artwork of wild horses and you're in wild horse country, but all you see around are cattle. And I read, I'm not going to get the statistics right on this, but I read somewhere the other day that the actual yield of these operations that are farming their cattle on public lands, the end input of what that's delivering to our supply of meat in the United States alone, it's some less than like 5 or 10%. It's so small that it's, are we even going to notice if those operations, you know, just disappeared and we let wild horses reign? But on the other hand, and I used to be such a staunch advocate of like, wild horses come first, you know, I'm not a rancher, I'm not a cattle person, so I can easily just turn a blind eye to their interests. But it's, there's so much rage between the wild horse advocate community and the livestock industry that I see that it's not helping anyone to just say, yeah, let's put more wild horses out there and less cattle. We also have this imagery of, like, as strong as that romantic image of the wild horse, the cowboy of the West is such a part of our like cultural heritage that I think it would be just as sad to see like all of these ranching operations that have been like generations upon generations just die out because, you know, we decide that this one species should get priority. Like, it can't just be a scale putting one above the other. It's this huge multi-layered conversation, and ultimately no one's going to win completely, right? But we all have to just see eye to eye. And that's the scariest thing, is so many people in America just don't want to talk to each other because they have different opinions, especially right now. So it's a scary time, I think, for Mustangs especially.
I think you're right. It's, how often does it work out for the local species when we kick the commercial interests off the land? And then eventually somebody with a lot of money decides, you know what, nobody's using this, I'm going to use it for something. I mean, I think the oil reserves and the conversation we could have about caribou are a great conversation of that. Oh, nobody's up there, we could find a better use for this, even if there is some importance.
Well, there's actually a lot of overlap with looking at human and elephant conflict and how elephants are defined differently by different groups of people. And I think that art installation that you were discussing is a really, really good parallel, because it shows that romanticization of the beautiful wild creature that's outside of human control, and yet we seek to control it. And in addition, the idea that the way we define them is different depending on geography. It's very similar with the elephants. You have advocates that are, every elephant should be protected above humans. They deserve to be free. But then we have locals that are experiencing crop raiding and potential harmful and violent interactions with these elephants. And to them, it's not this beautiful wild creature. It's a pest. It's feral, as the horses or dogs or other pest adjacent creatures get defined. And I think that one of the things that really stuck out to me is how not only are we romanticizing the wildness of these creatures, we're also seeking to control it, and we're glorifying that control. It never occurred to me there'd be a competition for gentling a Mustang as quickly as possible and making it do tricks. And that's just baffling to me. And like I said before we got started, I really don't have any experience with horses, but so maybe that's my own romanticization of the horses coming out because I don't have that direct experience. But I just can't imagine taking a wild animal and having a competition about who can break it the fastest. Mm-hmm. And So it's interesting to see that that contradiction between trying to manage them in a way that benefits both the humans and the horses, and the humans in the area where the horses are being taken from, and then putting it in the form of a competition just feels so violently American. Like, is that a rude way to say that? But you know what I mean? Like, it takes something to do with human execution of control and makes it a game. Right. And that really stuck out to me.
Especially the extreme, the way Shannon highlighted before, that word is very telling, I think. Like Rebecca said, the kind of culturally is sort of jumbo size, extreme, kind of this sort of way of labeling things as is kind of has this American feel to it. Like, I can't really see in other places there maybe being an extreme Mustang makeover in that sense, but it is interesting that how the terminology is something that keeps coming up in all of our discussions on this podcast, but you know, especially kind of very concentrated almost in this conversation, you can see how these terms just keep coming up of coming back to the terminology used and what impact that has, like how we speak about other animals and the practices of our interactions with them and everything.
Well, and especially when we talk about these terms in a socioeconomic context as opposed to a distinctly biological one, we see the nuance of how a term like feral is used in different contexts, either to protect, to excuse behavior, to identify as a pest. And it's the same thing with wild. Like, I'm interested to hear that wild in this context applies protection to them. That's kind of, I guess, a shift from a lot of the ways wild is used to almost demonize. And so I thought that was interesting. That's kind of what I was trying to say before with how different definitions are applied by different groups, by different regions. And it's just interesting to me that wild is only applied within those controlled areas because it seems inherently contradictory.
The very similar situation with Australian dingoes. If they're called wild dogs, they're protected under the government. If they're considered feral or domestic dogs, then they're pests and they're exterminated. And the same thing, if they wander out of protected lands, if they wander onto a ranch, they will be shot. So just everything you're describing, Shannon, is basically the same story in Australia with a completely different animal. And I think it's fascinating how this repeats. And I'm sure this is the case with some other species in some other part of the world. And yeah. I love that we can draw this similarity from so many different places.
Right. And what is really standing in the way for us to better manage them is, if we're calling them wild, then how can we interfere with them on a level, even like birth control wise? A lot of advocates have a problem with that, where they think that it's going to change their herd behavior, their breeding dynamic. It's going to change everything about the way that they migrate. Just these basic ways we're really shooting ourselves in the foot just to keep that word there. And even then, you know, it doesn't have to be I think, yes, wild could best be used legally just to keep them safe, just to keep them from being this pest that everyone wants to get rid of. But I think the wild horse advocacy perspective has been like inflated to the point where it's a balloon, it's about to explode. And the ones that are gonna really feel the harm of that are the horses themselves. And I've been really shocked in my research to learn too that I have always kind of said like roundups are cruel to the horses, you know, helicopter facilitated roundups the way that they do it now. It is easy to just put a photo of a helicopter chasing a wild horse and say like this should be banned permanently. But as I've learned in my research, what used to be done, old school mustanging, mustang hunters as they called themselves, or mustangers, so they would just set out on their saddle horses roping mustangs like as many as they could at a time, which I can't imagine really made any dent in their population. Or they would take out their trucks and they would lasso a horse, tie a tire to the end of it, and just let the horse exhaust itself until they were able to drag them onto the bed of the truck. And this was like the most cringy. It's really hard to learn about because, you know, it's just completely contrary to us actually caring for them and managing them. And I'm sure I've heard some accounts of mustangers that look back on what they did and they're horrified and they feel so much guilt and it haunts them. And so they don't want to be managing the horses this way. But we as advocates get into trouble when we say, no, roundups should not happen. And advocacy organizations could actually, they can sue the BLM for a proposed roundup. And that can just halt the process completely. So the BLM can say, okay, there are 200 too many horses in this HMA, let's bring them in. And an advocacy group, for instance, thousands of miles away can say, nope, that's cruel, you're not gonna do it. And then what happens is the horses then are gonna go through a season of not enough water, not enough food. And it's not the advocates that are watching over them, seeing them have to struggle and die of starvation, die of thirst. It's just that they don't want to see them rounded up by helicopter because that's cruel. So all these labels are just really not in the interest of the horses themselves in that way. And yeah, if we're not there, shouldn't we give precedence to locals who are seeing them suffer and saying like, yes, we don't want to round them up, we like seeing them out here, but not if they're skin and bones and just suffering.
Just so complicated. I mean, and I guess selfishly, I kind of love how complicated it is because I feel like it explains why we can't solve something in two steps. But it does remind me of just, again, if, you know, going back to what I was suggesting, you have an animal where people will latch onto the biological, which brings in the ego, brings in the all of those things, the biological definitions of things like wild and domestic. And then, but again, like sort of Rebecca and you were saying, but it's more nuanced than that. And those labels are there, maybe not for the biological, but for other pieces that matter. And I guess where I'm sort of going with this comment is how, and maybe not going to happen in our generation, how do we bring the public knowledge closer to this understanding of what we're talking about right now, about these words are more nuanced and domestication from an anthropological lens is maybe contrary sometimes to the biological lens, and we have to be okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I don't have an easy answer for you.
That's okay.
Again, I don't think there is an easy answer.
Yeah. It feels like the more that I learn, the more I really don't know. And I thought just in my dissertation alone, like, okay, now I'll have an idea for a future research project that would help them on the range. But, and that's always my goal is like, okay, how can what I'm doing with these horses that have been rounded up and brought in because they can't stay on the range, how can that influence the ones that do so that the cycle doesn't keep repeating itself? But ultimately, I think what I'm finding is it doesn't have to be this problem of like, okay, the government is not managing them properly on the range. And so we have to then just, you know, fight every step of the way of the way that they're proposing these new ideas. I think if we could embrace the fact that these horses are going to come into the domestic world, whether we like it or not, just to have these few horses still left on the range, I think that's a small price to pay. Like, okay, they don't have to suffer, they don't have to be overpopulated, and they don't have to clash with other like commercial or ranching interests. They can just be these beautiful, what we call in the horse world, like pasture ornaments. Like so many people love just driving past like a big open pasture and seeing horses in it. They're not questioning like, oh, are those horses eating enough? Are they, you know, are they getting enough exercise? They just want to see like, ah, animals out in the open. So I think as long as a small percentage, it's not going to be as many as advocates want, are allowed to be out there, then we can focus more on the horses that have to come into the human world. And to rectify that, it's like we have to change our perception of what is wild and what is natural, what is human. You know, we are not tainting these horses by interacting with them. And I think why, even in the natural horsemanship world, so many people have an issue with that, not just with Mustangs, but they rail against owning or caring for horses because they want to see them as these like free, independent creatures that don't need humans. But what happens then if you decide, no, I'm not going to get involved with these horses because I want them to be free of human interaction, then they're probably going to end up at like the auction yard. And the reality of that is the slaughter pipeline that many people are blind to also, which still exists.
I think the conflict that you're talking about, that's that inherent power dynamic, is reflective of our relationship with most non-human species. I mean, an example I think I've brought up before is my cats are indoor cats because I live in an area where there's a good chance they'd get hit by a car or attacked by an animal. And I joke with them. I say, no, you can't leave your prisoner, when they run towards the door. But I mean, I think I'm doing the right thing for them because I'm the one that can make the conscious decision about the risk of them being outside. And so I think there's a lot there. We could probably do a whole episode on looking at what our responsibilities are as being, as the person who's in a more powerful position and a more knowledgeable position in some ways, versus how much agency we can give them without knowingly putting them at risk.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Shannon, for coming on and speaking with us. Thanks for Molly and Rebecca for being in this conversation as well. And yeah, we'll see you guys on the next episode.